Let's read now from Whispers from Eternity. I am the foam of happiness spumed out of the sea of thy joy. I am the ocean life bounding with the billows of joy. Endless eddies of my laughter spread through all hearts. When the time comes to depart, I will retire to wakeful sleep on the bosom of thy infinite joy, a ripple ever dancing with billows of all joy. I am a bubble of joy, struggling to burst and unite with the ocean of joy. I feel thy joy in all things. Make me a lighthouse of joy also, guiding storm-tossed vessels of life to safety on the shores of thy joy. Let every vine of my activity bear large grape clusters of thy joy. Let me drink the divine wine pressed from the grapes of all life's little joys. Now, here is a quiz. What is the main subject of this Whispers? Do you think the main subject is joy? That's the impression I got too. It appearing in every single sentence, often twice. When Swamiji edited Master's book of Whispers, he said Master's overflowing enthusiasm just carried him away. And Swami would joke about it, that there would just be so many different images. The bird of paradise is buried at the bottom of the ocean and then rides the submarine up to the surface where the eagle of discrimination lifts it into the heavens of roses. And Swami was just to tone it down just a little so that you could kind of follow the images and not end up so lost. But if that's the toned down version, I wonder what the original really was. But Master's really trying to make a very good point for us. He's trying to help us to understand that this world is not what it seems. Just as simple as that. In the reading today, worldly sight is very different than spiritual sight. And as Sri Yukteswar says, however, spiritual sight is not debilitating. It does not make you dumb. The spiritually aware person sees this world differently, but he doesn't hide from the reality of it. It's not dumbness. Spiritual insight is not dumbness. It's seeing exactly what this world is and then realizing that there's another power behind it. And here we are at Christmas time, where we're celebrating again an event from 2,000 years ago, because we feel, not more than just it being an opinion, because we experience that there is a living reality to this, that time and space and distance and death and history and multiple translations through many languages, co-opting by institutions, theologies, dogmas, all of it, doesn't make any difference, because behind it there is a living, pulsing, omnipresent, ever-present, ever-new, ever-existing, ever-conscious bliss. And this little event, I mean this little baby being the concept, this birth of this little baby is a doorway that opens, that takes us out into those exuberant worlds of joy that Master is describing in his little Whispers. And the paradox of it, it can't be lost, because everybody who knows about the baby Jesus also knows that the end of the story, or I should say the last chapter visible in this world, was not at all this celebration of birth. It was a rather gruesome and terrible and terrifying experience of death. But then on the other side of the death, there was this triumph over all that darkness again, which goes on with this ever-living reality of Jesus. A friend wrote me recently. She periodically writes me interesting questions, and I do my best to answer. This one was, how do I explain to people how I can experience the presence, how a God-realized master can be equally present in a personal way for every single person on earth, if they would open to that. I wrote back and I said, I have no idea. I have heard my friend Purushottama, who writes under his English name Joseph Selby, The Physics of God, very, very good book if you haven't seen it. And he talks about, you know, how all the scientific world is now supporting all the spiritual ideas. I suggested to her, if she's capable of understanding that, that might work. Whenever I read his book or listen to him speak, in the moment that I'm in direct contact with it, I understand it. In the moment that his words are coming into my ears, I understand it. The instant it stops, it stops. So I know it's out there, and I know it's compelling, but it doesn't work for me. I've heard many of my friends talk about it, but it doesn't work for me. I said, the only answer I can give is, I've experienced it. And I'm the first to say that you can't support it with logic. When Swami Kriyananda was still living, and I could also talk to him on the telephone or through the email or through letters or through personal visits, but that was not the only time he communicated with me. Now that Swami Kriyananda is off of this planet, he communicates with me. He's just there. Not always. I wish it were always. In our affirmation about the remembrance of God's presence, you know, we start where we start and we do our best and we forget and we remember, we forget and we remember. Fortunately, Swamiji tends to, when I'm really getting off track, he'll really intrude. He'll wake me up in the night and tell me. And I can't verify it. It's a totally subjective experience. But Jesus answered that question in the Bible. How can you tell a true prophet from a false one? Which that question can be asked, how can you tell a true from a false? Add whatever you want. By their fruits, you shall know them. By the experience. And a great deal of spiritual life is direct experience. And then the second step after that is learning to trust that experience, not with spiritual dumbness, but with a greater insight, reason, and intelligence that we would apply to any other very important aspect of our lives. What are the fruits of this? What are the fruits of this? Am I freer? Am I kinder? Am I more patient? More loving? Am I more inspired? Am I more aware? Am I more sensitive? Or am I becoming insular and egotistical and tight and tense and brittle? We all know ourselves. We all live with ourselves. That's the giant problem of this planet, is that no matter where I go, there she is. If it were easy to offload her, I would have done it really a long time ago. It's just that we are who we are. And there is a point in our understanding where we may not be able to explain it at all. I mean, my whole life purpose is to say things, to put things into words. But the more I do it, the more I realize that you just reach an edge where you can spin words, but the words are just like a very, very abstract painting that you hope that somebody standing in front of it will just get a feeling from it. Although Swamiji did say, if you can't explain it to a child, you don't really understand it. And he would joke about writers who didn't really know exactly what they wanted to say, so they would weave enough words together, hoping that somebody else would be able to figure out what they were trying to say. I tried to insert a sentence like that into my book, Light Bearer, the book I wrote about Swamiji. It was a lot of good words, and they almost meant something. All I can say is Swami just harassed me. He wasn't living, of course. He was harassing me in my mind, just telling me, Asha, that's a terrible sentence. And I was arguing with him, as I did in life a great deal, you know. But sir, and I sort of played out the words and showed him. He says, yes, you're right. It almost means something, but it doesn't actually mean anything. And he just kept after me. Finally said, all right, I'll get rid of it. And as soon as I did, that was it. He stopped harassing me after that. We were actually laughing at a certain point. It was so real. And I don't think it was my imagination, but how can I explain it? Except that he wanted the book to be a certain way, and I was taking a shortcut that he knew I shouldn't take. You know, say, really say it or don't say it. In other words, know what you mean. So now we find ourselves here at Christmas time and on our altar, and you can see it with the camera, and I know it'll go in closer at other times. We have this beautiful nativity scene that those of us, when we were a group of us, mostly from this community in Jerusalem in January, that particular nativity scene, we saw it in many different places, many different churches there, until we finally found a place where it was sold. The church, Galicante, it's called, which I think means the cry of the rooster, because it commemorates the place where Peter denied Jesus 3 times, as Jesus had predicted that he would. Then the dawn came and he heard the rooster crow. And then Peter knew, remembered what Jesus had said and was filled with remorse. Because Peter denied Jesus 3 times, and I knew that that church had something to do with fowl, F-O-W, fowl. I thought it was the 3 chickens. I thought that's what Galicante meant. And I would call it the Church of the 3 chickens until somebody corrected me. A little part of me was thinking that 3 chickens is a very odd name for a church, no matter what language. But in any case, it's a fabulous place. But they sold this particular creche scene, which we all really like, so we brought it back. It's one of the reasons that it's so dear is because it's made by French nuns. And so every time I look at any of those characters, and I imagine that somewhere, some woman whose life was dedicated to Jesus, whose life is dedicated to Jesus, they mold them out of stone, stone dust, I'm sure, they put them into molds, whatever the process is, then they're hand-painted. So you think of the little baby Jesus on Christmas Eve night, and again, even more on Christmas Day. We'll use all the little figures and you'll see them very, very closely. The little baby Jesus especially has a particularly sweet expression on his face. If I pick it up, can you see it? I just want you to see it, even if you can't. Do you see the bright light of Jesus around his head? Isn't that wonderful? I don't know if you can see how sweet his little face is. You can see it, marvelous. Okay? So some French woman, who knows how long she'd been in the convent, she held this little thing in her hand, and they come pure white because we saw them that way. She took a tiny little brush. She made him gold. She painted his hands. She painted his little face. You know, just so he would be just so. Now, why would she do that? And why is it, at least for me, when I look at and hold this little tiny, it's just a piece of stone. It's nothing in theory that has a spirit of its own, but you can't persuade me that it doesn't. How is it possible that Jesus can be present in every one of these little images? All at the same time. I can't explain it, but I know for a fact that it's true. So this is what happens to us when we begin to open ourselves to the possibilities. I'm going to give him back to his mother because she's a little worried. Here he comes. There he is, back in the manger. You know, now that I'm picking up images, I'll just pick up this one too. This is the younger brother of the image of Jesus that we've had here for years. He came to us a couple of years ago. Once again, like, who conceived of it? Who made it? And why? St. Joseph of Cupertino, about whom you heard through the wonderful class that 3 of our people here gave about different Christian saints. St. Joseph of Cupertino, because he levitated all the time and was always leaving the ground, and therefore I'm just going to be very rude, therefore put the lie to the idea that all priests are equally ordained. That's what happens. If one priest turns out to be a little more ordained than the other priests, like Padre Pio was or Joseph of Cupertino, it causes a lot of confusion because it's the institution that's supposed to give these priests power, and one of them has a little more. It doesn't work out well. So the priests themselves actually have a name for it. They get sent to prison. And Joseph of Cupertino was sent to prison, which is he was confined to quarters in some rooms, if I have the timing right, in the lower levels of the Basilica of St. Francis. And if you have some contacts there, or if you get there at the right time, you get to go down into Joseph of Cupertino's rooms. And he was there for like 6 or 7 years, I think, just sort of virtually in seclusion. He has an image of the baby Jesus down there. Now, we don't talk about this as much in the West as they know about it in the East. In the East, there's a word for it. It's called Ishtadeva. It's my chosen form of God. What form I wish to worship God in. And it seems that Joseph of Cupertino, who was a very gentle spirit, liked the baby Jesus. That was the aspect that appealed to him. So he had this beautiful doll that actually looked not dissimilar to this one, now that I think about it. And it was enshrined there, and he took care of it all the time, as if he was the father and it was his child. I'm going to put this back right now. Now, a rational mind would say, oh, it's just mortar and clay or whatever it might be. But let's not have rational minds. Let's have hearts. The other image, the reason that the image of Jesus that we've used for 25 years now has a baby brother is because the other one that we have, which is a little larger, is made out of ceramic. This one is unbreakable fiberglass because of the story I'm about to tell you. We had this, it's ceramic, and he came from Rome. He's an Italian Catholic, the other little one we have. I think this one is Italian too. And he lived right near the Vatican with about 25 identical brothers. And he was personally purchased, and we went in there, and we looked at all the brothers, and there was one of them that said it belonged to us, and so we carried him home like this. But at all times, there was this concern because he was ceramic, so we're always really super careful with him. And about 2 or 3 years ago, fortunately, it was I was here. I say fortunately because I wouldn't want anyone else to have had to bear this. I was here. I was actually right on this dais, and I was doing something with the image of the baby because I was decorating or costuming or something like that. And I just lay him down. I swear, I just lay him down really gently like that. And there was this awful noise, this crack sound, and his body and his head separated. And it was like 2 days before Christmas. And there it was. When I told a friend of mine, she sang to me, "Away in a manger, away in a manger, no crib for his bed. The little Lord Jesus lay down his sweet head." So here I am. And it wasn't just the practical matter, which is, you know, we do all this pageantry holding this doll and all of this. It was that my baby just got decapitated. I've lived with that baby Jesus for, you know, 25 years. And all of a sudden, you know, he didn't have a head anymore. There was apparently a very loud exclamation came out of my mouth. It wasn't unkind, it was just agonizing. And people came from several areas to see what had happened, you know, and there it was. I took him to the urgent care clinic, which was one of the men in our community is a luthier. He makes guitars, and I figured if he could make guitars, he could put the head back on the baby Jesus, which he did. We took him there in a sort of an ambulance, and then we fixed him, and then we kept him in the ICU. And actually, he seems to be fine. And we used him, but in between, we got a spare because it was a little scary. And his spare turned out to be like so much smaller and different. He has his own role. He has his own life of his own now. Now, I'm telling you all this because I really mean it all. It's all exceedingly true. When we first started using, we used to use real babies. Whoever was the last family in the community, they would be the holy family. But we had a couple of nice babies, but babies that didn't really work very well as the baby Jesus. One of them absolutely refused to let go of his mother's breast. And so therefore, we knew that there was a baby Jesus somewhere under all those shawls, but no one else ever really got to know that. That wasn't good. And then one baby just simply protested at the indignity of the entire thing in a very loud screeching voice and never ceased for the entire night. That also was not exactly what we wanted. So then we went to Murti's. And Murti is a real word. It's the personification of the divine. And a Murti is inanimate until it's animated, until it becomes real. And then after that, it's the deity incarnate. Now, we're a little unorthodox because I do put Jesus back in his box and I say goodbye to him and I close him in there. I don't feed him, bathe him, take him out for air, or put him down to rest 24 hours a day, every day, as is really prescribed for a Murti. I'm still a little bit in conflict about this. I'm never quite sure if it's an okay thing to do. But that is the way that we have chosen to handle it. But I always know he's there, and I always know he's waiting for Christmas. I can't explain it, but it's real. And the first time we ever had an inanimate baby, we had a midwife's model of a newborn. That's what it was, and it was exceedingly real. Not real pretty, but exceedingly real, with these wonderful little hands, and it was just the size of a newborn. And when I had to bring it to the church for the first time, I just carried it like this. And somebody saw me getting into my car, and they said, "Has she had a baby?" You know, like, how did this happen that Asha became the mother of a small child all of a sudden? But it was and is the baby Jesus. And this is really what God is asking us to do. He's asking us to see that behind all of this seemingly inanimate reality, there's something so living and so joyful. It's what he's saying in the Whispers from Eternity. This little bubble here, the edge of this bit of the ocean, always behind it all, let me see this joy, joy, joy. And the joy of Jesus' birth is bookended with the crucifixion, and then it's bookended by the resurrection. But Jesus' life didn't turn out to be the triumph in this world at the time that people thought it would be. And isn't that the story of all of our lives too? You know, we start out with this idea of what it's going to be, whether it's our spiritual expectation or our worldly expectation, romantic, fame, glory, artistic success, whatever it might be. It's always this strange mixture, isn't it? Of the rejoicing and the crucifixion. But the real story behind it, the real vibration behind it, is the extraordinary, the hero's journey. The hero's journey from delusion to realization and the absolute certainty that God himself is like he's pulling the strings at the other end. It's like we're on this very, 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 and it is a very, very long bungee cord, if you will, that we've just leapt out into delusion and we're boinging around in that delusion. But in the end, the divine is pulling on that. And one of the things we have to realize, and this is just so deep and so important, is that God is always calling us. Just in the midst of everything, when I joke about Swamiji telling me to get rid of that paragraph in that book or various other things, many, many things that have happened since then, where I'll just be going in a certain direction and I'll hear him say to me, are you really sure? I'm not really sure that's the best idea, because they're holding the other end of it and they're just wanting us to listen. And yes, we have to be intelligent and adult. We have to act, you know, like we know what we're doing in this world. We can't just be airheads. I mean, if God makes you an airhead like Joseph of Cupertino, who made him a complete air, you know, he was just going right off the ground. St. Teresa of Avila used to cling to the pew so that she wouldn't elevate. I mean, really, these are not the problems that most of us have. But those things really do happen. But spirituality is not dumbness. It's the innocence and the freedom of being deeply devoted to the spiritual dimension of life. It's not because we're pretending. It's not because we're afraid. It's not because it's too ugly and we don't want to look at it. Because it is pretty ugly. You know, a friend again also wrote to me recently, and he described a heartbreaking interaction that he'd had with someone who he thought was a friend. Just sort of explained it to me in great detail, I think just to be able to sort of say it out loud. I read the letter, I meditated on it for a long time. I wrote back and I said, everybody gets their heart broken, that's what this world is like. I said, I wish there was something else I could say. But the challenge to us is this: just because other people are conditional in their love for us, are we going to be conditional in our love for them? Just because they fail to meet our expectations and demands, are then we just going to fold up our arms and close our hearts and just go off and we'll show them all right? Really, who are we showing? What are we proving? This is why we celebrate the life of Christ. He came into this world with this, you know, this time of year we all just get to pretend. We all just get to pretend that it's going to be like this forever. But the truth is, it's not pretending. It just depends on which side of the coin we want to look at. Yeah? This world is very disappointing. But Swamiji's statement in regard to other people's suffering is so powerful. Whenever he would see people really going through difficult times, he was filled with compassion. But he would say, this is the kind of suffering that causes people to turn to God. This is the kind of suffering that breaks our hearts and then opens us up to a new possibility. And that new possibility is we can take this little ceramic baby Jesus and feel in it the infinite promise of Satchitananda, of God himself. You know, if you want to rationalize it out, it's just a little piece of ceramic, maybe artistically done, but it isn't. Because it's the doorway. Opening our heart to that possibility opens us to what Master was saying in his Whispers from Eternity, joy here, joy there, more joy over here, joy this way, joy that way. When I stumble and fall, I fall into a pool of joy. When I die, I go into a pool of joy. Do we? Not always. Can we? Will we? Yes. Take this season of Christmas, take that little baby into your heart, hold it with everything you have, and just like St. Joseph, never let it go. Perhaps keep an image if you wish. Whether you wish to keep one outward or not is up to you. But take that little baby, bind him to your heart, and you will find, I mean, the symbol is too obvious. It starts as a baby and grows powerful enough to transform the whole world, beginning with the little world of my own self. God bless you.
The Christ child's asleep, the silence is so deep, that round about with hope in their eyes, the animals await, their breathing they abate, they know their time has come to arise. For Jesus came on earth to offer second birth to all who would the blessing receive. The inner peace he brings can lift us on soul wings to soar in light and heaven perceive. Our pleasures and pains, our losses and gains, have kept us long bound. The ropes of yearning hemmed us round. We dreamed of imposing on desert sand, flower gardens of beauty, verdant vales of delight. Imagination misted our sight. The freedom we would know, Christ offered long ago, and even from his slumber flows peace. All creatures here on earth, alive to their own worth, can welcome love and win their release. The Christ child's asleep, the silence is so deep, that round about with hope in their eyes, the animals await, their breathing they abate. They know their time has come to our